The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and that, my friends, is our new theme song. We've got a busy show today. A little later on, we'll be speaking to the fantastic Dr. Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education about how to communicate evolution. But I wanted to have a quick moment with A-OK, the lovely gentleman who submitted the winning theme song. Hello, A-OK.
Hi, thanks for calling me lovely.
Thank you so much for the song.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for selecting it in your contest.
So now, before we actually talk any more about it, let's play the rest of the song, because that was only the instrumental portion, and we'll use that at the top of the show, but here's what we'll say goodbye with.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever, Desiree Schell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, because we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, woo, I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever, Desiree Schell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
I love that.
If any gangsters or wayward youth should turn to science in the future, I'm going to have to take credit for that.
I completely acknowledge your right to do that. And so what brought that on, sir?
A contest by Skeptically Speaking to find a new theme song, and a steadfast interest in the skeptical movement. So, and a hobby as a rapper as well.
Now, and that's actually what I want to mention, because this is not your first time on the show. You've been on a couple times, and you don't consider yourself a skeptical rapper. And I find that interesting. Is that because it's more subversive to do regular rap and stick in the science and doubt and such, or?
I think it's just because, well, I guess I'm a skeptical rapper. I'm also a political rapper and a humorous rapper, and I mean, in the end, I'm just a rapper and an independent rapper, and I cover different facets of different ways of different music.
So, do you think it's an important distinction at all between skeptical rapper
and rapper?
I don't know, red rapper.
Well, I mean, I'd hate to be pigeonholed as, you know, as the Bill Nye of hip hop. Actually, maybe I'd love
Actually,
to be pigeonholed
that's
as the Bill
awesome.
Nye of hip hop. That sounds really cool. Yeah, that sounds like a great reputation, actually.
Well, thanks to everyone that submitted theme songs. They were all wonderful, but this one had lyrics that made me giggle. So. That really makes my decision. And also, you know, raise a little hell, metaphorically speaking.
Yes, because we're skeptically speaking, of course.
That is one of my all-time favorite phrases.
You can't raise what doesn't exist.
So thanks, everybody else. Those of you who agreed, we'll be using your theme songs in our next week's ads. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And where can people find your album and you?
They can find it on iTunes. If they're in the greater Edmonton area, they can find it at Megatunes, Blackbird Music, and that's it.
And your website?
Is assaultofknowledge.com.
Perfect. And next up, we have some Facebook activism. Travis Roy, president of the Granite State Skeptics, is on the line. Hello, Travis.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking.
Well, it's great to be here.
So you were recently involved in a successful campaign. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Basically, what was going on in Australia, there was a TV show with called Today Tonight that Richard Saunders, the vice president of the Australian Skeptics, was on, debunking the claims of a product. The name of the product was the Power Balance Bracelet. And it's a small silicone bracelet with a hologram in it, where they claim that the embedded frequency in it will react with your body's own electromagnetic fields and give you increased strength and flexibility. So on the show, they put it to the test in a blind test, and it failed. Every time when they did the open test, it worked. But when they did the blinded test, it didn't work. So then some members of the Australian Skeptics went on Facebook and they started questioning their claims on the Australian version of their Facebook page. Shortly after, they shut that down and they moved on to the company's official Facebook page. At that point, I joined in and we started doing basically the same thing. The interesting thing that happened in that case was that there was a particular person that was a believer, and at one point we finally said to her, listen, don't listen to us, but don't listen to them either. Do the test for yourself. So I gave her a protocol to test the bracelet for herself, where she wouldn't know which bracelet she had. She did the test and changed her mind. So then she started helping us. And then also people that claimed to work for the company started messaging us separately. And we said, no, we don't want that. We want you, if you're going to discuss the product, you're going to discuss it in the open. And they kept sending us private messages. So the group of us started taking screenshots of the private messages and putting them in the general feed for the Facebook page. So shortly after that, we don't know if Facebook took the page down, because we also made complaints to Facebook, or if the company took the Facebook page down, but it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's no longer up.
So, and the only one that's still up, I believe, is the Spanish Facebook page?
There's two foreign language ones. One of them's a Spanish one, and I checked right before the show, and the Canadian page is still up, and it's getting fully assaulted.
Do you know who it's being assaulted by?
The same people. I haven't really joined in on that one yet, but there's some Australian skeptics that are in there that are asking for proof and putting up the link to the video with Richard in it debunking the claims.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes.
So the only potential issue I see with this is that since they've taken the page down, there's actually less accessible contradictory information about the power bracelet.
That's been brought up on a number of times by other people.
Maybe anybody listening, if you have some free time, do start a Facebook page. Would you suggest this kind of activism for other groups?
Yes, definitely. And not only just with this. There was anything that anybody can do personally will work, because for example, just a couple weeks ago, I was driving into work and I heard a infomercial on the radio for some kind of, I forget exactly what it's called, but it was basically some mega dosing vitamin C supplement. And I went to their website and they had all kinds of claims, and they had specific health claims that they're not supposed to make, such [S2] Right. [S1] As that it lowered cholesterol, lowered your blood pressure. I mean, people are going to take this and they're going to stop taking their proper medication, and that's dangerous. So I filed a complaint with the FDA. I emailed the radio station, which unfortunately never responded, but they haven't run it since that I know of. So
is this something that you and a group of people, like the Granite State Skeptics, did you decide as a group that this would be something that you would, that like an actual campaign, or is this sort of more informal?
This was more informal. It kind of just happened. It was in between our meetings. We have our meetings are once a month, so it was in between meetings, and Richard's video got posted, and then we started working on it. I did get it. What was interesting was that it got shut down the day of our meeting. So at our meeting, I got to announce that, and the group of people, I got a nice round of applause. So that was nice. But I did mention to them that in the future, if anything like this should come up, that we should do it as a group. It might be more powerful.
That's I think this is a wonderful example of activism that groups can get involved in. So
yeah, it was a lot of fun too.
That's thank you on behalf of us all.
Oh, my pleasure.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
And you can visit Travis at the Granite State Skeptics website. That's granitestateskeptics.org to find out more about them. And we will be right back with Dr. Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including LP99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, CJAI 92.1, Amherst Island Radio Broadcasting, Inc., and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're on the line with Dr. Eugenie Scott, the Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. NCSE is a not-for-profit membership organization that provides information and resources for schools, parents, and citizens working to keep evolution in the science curriculum in the U.S. schools. Eugenie holds a PhD in physical anthropology from the University of Missouri, and she's a former university professor, author of the book Evolution versus Creationism, and she's been a researcher and activist in the creationism-evolution controversy for over 25 years. Thanks very much for being here, Eugenie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. So I guess to start out, in Canada, we don't necessarily have the same sense of urgency about this issue. And a lot of people in this country actually wonder what the big deal is at all. So maybe can you give us a bit of background about the teaching of evolution in the U.S.?
Well, in the U.S., I think the problem is much more overt and much more noisy. And I think we have we've just had a lot more public history about this problem. I think you have a problem with anti-evolutionism in Canada. It's just that it's not as obvious as it is here. People know about the Scopes trial in the United States in 1925, partly because of all the iconography and the play and the movie Inherit the Wind and so forth. There's just been so much pop culture around the creation and evolution controversy. And of course, there's always, you know, because we're so much a larger country, there are always so many more polls, and there's just so much more in your face with the religious right in this country. And indeed, there is a very high level of anti-evolutionism in the United States. But you know, the conservative religious movement of Protestant Christianity, that's kind of the bedrock of anti-evolutionism in the United States, is also coloring the Canadian version of Christianity too. I mean, it's pretty much a North American phenomenon. It's not just an American phenomenon. And North American Christianity tends to be more conservative than European and British Christianity. And as a result, we tend to have more of an anti-evolution tradition in North America than you find in the continent and Great Britain. So if you actually look at the polls, the numbers and percentages of Canadians and Americans rejecting evolution are not that far apart. One of my board members of the National Center for Science Education is a faculty member at McGill University who trains teachers. And so he spends a lot of time talking to teachers in the classroom and training teachers who will go into the classroom. And he's got a pretty good finger on the pulse, so to speak, of what goes on in science education in Canada. And he tells me that there's a surprising amount of pushback, shall we say. It varies, obviously, depending on where you are. It's stronger in the prairie provinces and stronger in the Pacific Northwest and so forth. But there are many parts of Canada, as well as the United States, where teachers just tend to skip evolution because they feel it's controversial. They feel that members of the community really don't want their children to learn it. And so they tend to avoid teaching it, and of course, that's not very good. In Canada, you do have an advantage because you have more of a top-down education system than we have in the United States. In the States, we have a very decentralized education system where most of the decisions about what you teach and what gets taught are made at the local level. And we have these elected school boards that have a lot of responsibility for those decisions about what the curriculum is going to be. In Canada, it's pretty much the provincial ministers make those decisions, and it's very top-down, and you will teach what the provincial curriculum tells you to teach.
Right.
And that's an advantage, really, believe me.
Well.
Because, you know, the decision is you will teach evolution, and so, you know, you at least have that mandated.
Agreed. But, for example, in Alberta, where I live, our province did pass Bill 44. Now, have you heard about this?
Yes, I have.
For anybody who hasn't, it's an amendment to the human rights legislation, and it requires that school boards give parents written notice when controversial subjects are going to be covered, and it also gives parents the option of pulling their children out of class when lessons on sex, religion, or sexual orientation are being taught. And additionally, this makes it possible for parents to file human rights complaints against teachers and school districts when proper notice isn't given, which is frightening, quite honestly.
Yeah, it's not a very good idea. It's not very good educational policy, really.
So do you think that that Bill 44 is a sign of Canada moving in the same direction as the U.S.?
Well, notice that it's in Alberta. I mean, it's in a very conservative part of the country. There's a reason for it.
We also have, quite recently, we have the Texas mega churches coming in and buying up land within Alberta as well.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's not too encouraging.
No.
You have my sympathy.
Thank you. We and actually, speaking of taking people out of school, I believe we have a question on that topic from the website.
How concerned should we be that many children miss out on any chance of understanding evolution due to homeschooling? Where could these children go to get unbiased information?
And why I think that's related is it's homeschooling children are potentially missing out on evolution education. But if students are being pulled out of school altogether when these classes are being taught, that's effectively the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's something to be very concerned about. I guess we can hope for adolescent rebellion to kick in at some point, and you know that kids will leave that sort of cotton batting existence and go out and learn what the real world is all about. But really, parents do have the right to educate their children and to raise them the way they want. Eventually, children do grow up and they do learn about the real world, hopefully, and leave their parents. Homes and environment, but yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do until children do leave home. Parents do have the right to control the environment of their children. We live in democratic societies. We cannot and really don't want to force parents to do things just because we think we know better how to raise their children. People will be able to make decisions for themselves once they leave home. And we can only hope that if we make information readily available, hopefully people will avail themselves of that information, and we can hope that they will avail themselves of that information, and it'll be persuasive. But, you know, it's a democratic, it's a free society. We cannot force people to accept ideas.
So I think one of the interesting issues about the entire evolution education issue is the fact that it isn't necessarily that people want to not teach evolution now. They want to teach the controversy. So can you tell us what that means?
Well, it means various things to various people. Teach the controversy in the words of the Discovery Institute is code for pretend to students that scientists are arguing over whether evolution ever happened, and pretend to students that there's a whole mass of evidence out there that evolution didn't happen. And so teach students a lot of misinformation about the evidence against evolution or the flaws of evolution or the critical analysis of evolution, whatever particular buzz phrase or buzzwords they're using at the time. Typical creationist arguments like the Cambrian explosion is a great weakness of evolution and other nonsense like that. Teach the controversy sometimes is misunderstood by the public to mean, well, you know, gee, there's a controversy within the public about some people don't want their kids to be taught evolution, and yet scientists think evolution is really important. So it's a public controversy in that sense, and certainly it is. It's legitimate to teach students that, yeah, people argue about evolution, but that's not what teach the controversy means. You know, teach the controversy in the mind of the anti-evolutionists is a false, made-up controversy about whether evolution actually happened, which in the scientific world is not a controversy at all. Nobody in the scientific world is sitting up at night worrying about whether living things had common ancestors. We argue about the details, but that's not what Teach the Controversy is about. Teach the Controversy is a manufactured controversy about whether living things had common ancestors, which, like I say, is not something scientists are arguing
right.
about.
So, actually, we have a question from the chat room, I believe.
Yes, this comes from Grassroots Skeptics. Is NCSE or anyone doing any kind of election tracking, monitoring for anti-evolution candidates in school board elections?
Well, considering that there is such a huge number of school boards around the country, we really can't monitor each individual school board election. We really depend upon our members and allies and people on the local level to sort of monitor that. There is something like 15,000 school boards in the United States. I mean, there's no way we can keep our finger on each of those pulses. Secondly, we have a problem, of course, because as a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 is the nonprofit code in the U.S., we cannot support or oppose candidates for election. That is the absolute no-no in terms of maintaining our nonprofit status. So we do not take a position on elective offices whatsoever. So no, we don't monitor candidates at all.
All right, audience, if you have questions about evolution in the classroom, do give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So going back to the concept of intelligent design, is it basically just creationism light then?
Very much so. Very much so. One of the things that we learned when we have been, of course, tracking and studying the intelligent design movement, really, I've been studying it since its beginning, which is began before NCSE became a national organization. It actually started in the early mid-1980s. But it actually began with the dissatisfaction of some conservative Christians with the creation science movement, which really wasn't being a very successful anti-evolution movement. It creation science wasn't being successful legally, and it wasn't being successful in the sense of appealing to a wide range of Christians because of its strong biblical literalist focus. And of course, you know, Catholics and mainstream Protestants aren't literalist, and so, you know, creation science really wasn't making the sale to them. So a form of anti-evolutionism that would just focus on the essence of anti-evolutionism, which really, when you come right down to it, is the design argument. The one thing that is so popular with anti-evolutionists is this idea that there's such terrific complexity out there in life, especially in biology, but also with the anthropic argument of the incredible complexity of the universe, you know. Especially things like biological complexity, the eye or the bacteria flagellum or molecular complexity, these wonderful things that you find in life, couldn't possibly be the result of natural causes. Could only be the result of an intelligent cause such as God. Take this kernel, this essence of unexplainable, miraculous wonderfulness of life, attribute it to God, and therefore evolution didn't take place. And so you have the wonderful explanation that only God can explain, and therefore you're not stuck with some of the goofier things that you find in young earth creationism, like a 10,000-year-old earth and flood geology and some of this other stuff that, you know, mainstream Christians really can't get along with.
Right.
So intelligent design really started out as a subset of young earth creationism. So I and most of the other people who really looked into this do consider it creationism light.
So what would the practical effect be then if intelligent design was taught alongside evolution in the classroom?
Well, the same thing as creation science. I mean, what you're getting is essentially a religious view masquerading as science, which does violence to the idea of science education itself, because what you're doing is teaching kids a distorted view of what science is. You're teaching kids that you can, with a wink and a nod, toss out the idea of what science truly is in favor of what is essentially a religious view. And you're also, for countries like the United States and Canada, in which the majority of people are religious, you are privileging one sectarian religious view over all others, which for most of the citizens in our countries is very offensive. So for both scientific reasons and religious reasons, it's a really bad idea.
Well, and that makes me question, is this only motivated by religion? Is there any secular opposition to the teaching of evolution in schools?
I have never run into anybody who opposes evolution because they think it's bad science. I mean, I have never encountered anybody who thinks evolution is bad science who did not have a religious reason for opposing it. Period. Zero.
That is definitive.
Not a single person.
Okay. So when we're talking about this, when we're talking about sort of what the National Center for Science Education is doing about this, you're only focusing on public schools, correct? You're not trying to change the curriculum in religious schools.
Well, we don't have to for the majority of religious schools. The majority of religious schools are Catholic and Lutheran. They already teach evolution. We don't have to mess with them. I'm constantly amused at the fact that when I, I'm always being told by members of NCSE, well, I send my kid to Catholic school so that she'll get evolution.
Oh my!
He's not getting it in the public schools, and that's very sad.
Huh. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Audience, again, if you have questions or comments about intelligent design or evolution in the school system, give us a call. It's 780-492-2577, extension 1. We're also at live at skepticallyspeaking.com and on Twitter at Skeptical Radio.
Actually, Desiree, I have a funny story to tell you. I was at Colorado State University a couple days ago, And I had lunch with a friend of mine who is actually a conservative Christian. He belongs to an organization called the American Scientific Affiliation. He's an evangelical Christian. He's a bit of a left-winger when it comes to evangelical Christians, because he really accepts evolution, and he's worked within the evangelical community to try to get his fellow evangelicals to accept evolution and still, you know, appreciate the fact that they can be evangelical Christians and accept evolution. And he told me that he homeschooled his kids rather than sending them to the local Christian schools, because he felt that by homeschooling his kids, he could teach them evolution, whereas they wouldn't get it in the Christian schools. So you have all sorts of combinations. Yet another anecdote about people wanting their kids to get evolution.
You know, and I've heard similar stories to that actually online about how Christian schools are doing this better. Why do you think that is? Is it a know thine enemy thing?
No. I know more about Catholic schools and Lutheran schools than other religious schools. I mean, there's a number. I mean, they're the Christian academies that tend to be evangelical, and, you know, of course, they teach that evolution is bunk, and so obviously they're not teaching the kind of view of evolution that we would like to see. But Catholic schools and evangelical Lutheran Church in America, ELCA Lutheran schools, teach evolution right, and of course Missouri Synod Lutheran schools don't. I mean, there's a huge variety out there. You know, some of the Presbyterians teach it right, some of the Presbyterians don't. The thing is, there's a huge variety of church schools out there, and you really have to know within the denomination the orientation, and it's not even the denomination itself. Like I say, some Presbyterians yes, some Presbyterians no, some Lutherans yes, some Lutherans no, Catholics are generally okay, and so forth. But at any rate, taking Catholics in general as an example, in a Catholic school, what tends to happen is they'll have religious classes and then they'll have the science classes. In the religious classes, they'll talk about the Catholic theological view. Now we'll read Genesis, and here's the Catholic view of Genesis. The Catholic view of Genesis is that, here's Adam and Eve, and the meaning of Genesis to Catholics is the promise of God to Adam and Eve that their responsibility to God is obedience, and God's responsibility to them is such and such, and this is this partnership, and on and on. It's symbolic. It's not that there were six 24-hour days. It's allegorical, etc.
Right.
So Catholic theology is not the six 24-hour days and the rib and all that kind of jazz. It's very different from a literal interpretation.
And
right?
it's all confusing.
It's okay for them to go next door to the biology class and hear about the Australopithecines, right? Now, with Catholic theology, what several popes have said is that there's something magical that goes on with the infusion of the soul into the first true human. Whatever kind of hominid that is, whether it's Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, Heidelberg man, or at some stage of human evolution, God infuses some kind of advanced hominid with a soul, and so that's sort of the Adam and Eve equivalent, if you will. But, you know, at that point you can start talking about Homo sapiens, and that kind of is where the theology and the actual biology sort of come together as far as the Catholics are concerned. So it all works, and they don't consider that there to be a conflict. So, you know, Catholic schools don't think that it's a big deal. Now, obviously, different Christian traditions are going to interpret this differently, but the important thing, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I'm not a believer, so I don't have a dog in this fight, but I'm just concerned that kids in the public schools, don't have people standing at the door with pitchforks trying
That's
to
exactly
keep the
it.
Science teachers from teaching biology.
Now, we actually
but
have
a... Why can they do this in the Christian schools, but they can't do it in public schools? I think they can get away with it in American, in the Christian schools, because they can say, here's how we can, you know, here's the theology. In American public schools, you can't do that, because obvious, number one, the First Amendment requires the public schools to be religiously neutral. You can't advance any particular religious view. You can't say, here's how we do it theologically, number one, because then you're proposing a religious view. You're advancing or supporting a particular religious view. You can't do that. That's unconstitutional. It would be inappropriate to do that in a public school. Number one, that may not be the view of all the students, and even if it was the view of all the students, it wouldn't be appropriate. There could be Jewish students, there could be Catholic, Baptist, Lutheran, all kinds of different kinds of Christian students. There could be Hindu students and Buddhist students. Goodness knows the pluralism of American students is huge. So the public school classroom has to be neutral. There can't be any kind of advocacy of religion or attacks on religion either, for all of that, in Americans' classes. So ironically, the fact that in a religious school you can overtly deal with the religious issues makes it possible to
right
to teach evolution,
to provide a quality education.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So we actually have a call. Caller, go ahead.
Oh, hi.
Hi, this is Doug from Edmonton.
Yes. I'm learning actually so much about the American education system while I'm listening. I don't know if my question's all that relevant or maybe slightly off topic, but I was just, and that's the American school system that will not allow any type of religious doctrine to be passed along in the classroom?
That's correct. You can discuss religion. You can say, this is what the Buddhists believe, this is what Jews believe, this is what Christians believe, this is what Catholics believe. You can't say, but the Jews are right, or the Baptists are right, or you can't advocate a particular religious view. You can't promote any particular religious view.
Oh, I think that's great. And I was my question was, is it reasonable to the average taxpayer, regardless of religious denomination, to be funding any of the private schools that the Canadian government funds? I know a lot of religious schools gain volume through their various communities and then get government funding. Should we be funding any schools that are not 100% secular? That's my question, ethically.
That's a great question. Thanks, sir. Go ahead, Eugenie.
I'm not going to venture an opinion on that. That's the way you do things in your country, and I'm not going to... I don't know your history.
That's very diplomatic.
Well, people do things differently in different countries. You have a different history, and I'm not really sure. I really don't know their history and why you do it that way, frankly. I should find out, and then maybe I'd have an opinion.
Well, what would you say about the U.S. in that case? Should taxpayers be funding schools that aren't completely secular?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because we have written into our Constitution the First Amendment of the Constitution, which calls for a neutrality toward religion. The First Amendment's first clause said that Congress shall make no laws either establishing religion or inhibiting the free exercise thereof. And taking the establishment and free exercise clauses together, that means that the government can neither advance nor inhibit religion. And that goes for any governmental institution, whether it's a school or any other kind of institution. That's why I mean that the schools have to be religiously neutral. And that's a wonderful provision, I think, of the United States government.
We have a question from the chat room.
Yes, this is from Talk 13. He asks, what will it take to kill the ID beast?
It's an interesting way to put it.
Well, the intelligent design movement is fairly new in one sense. It sort of started growing in the early to mid 1980s, so it's really only just a couple decades old. It's already morphed into a couple new forms. I suppose you can say that it's evolved as a result of pressures from the legal environment. Currently, it's morphed into it's abandoned its original form, which attempted to get it intelligent design taught alongside evolution in the public schools. And now what it's trying to do is get evidence against evolution taught alongside evolution in the public schools. Of course, by evidence against evolution, it merely means repackaging what the content of intelligent design into, you know, by calling it evidence against evolution. And they may get, you know, it'll be interesting to see how far they get with this strategy. We're looking at some bills that are being proposed in state legislatures around the country. There have been two proposed this month in January. We're watching another couple bills that have been pre-filed in South Carolina, and we expect some other bills to show up in some other states. And one bill has already been passed in Louisiana, and we're trying to see what happens with that. The Discovery Institute has written a book called Explore Evolution, which you might take a look at. The content of that book is what they expect teachers to teach in the guise of, quote, evidence against evolution. It's the usual bad science that we saw. It used to be called intelligent design, and then 20 years ago used to be called creation science. But it's the same old, same old. They just keep repackaging the stuff. I mean, basically what they'd really like us to do is just stop teaching evolution.
I get that
but
impression.
We can't do that. You know, we can't do that without abandoning good science.
We have a question from the website.
Yes. Can individual teachers who take it upon themselves to introduce creationism into science classes be stopped? What would the process be?
Well, what we have to do, first of all, is find them. And, of course, that can be very difficult. I mean, I have no doubt whatsoever that there are teachers around who are doing that right now. But unless the kid comes home and says, guess what we learned in school today, Mom? We'll never know. And how many kids do that?
Right.
This can go on for years and years, either because the parents don't know what's going on or agree with what's going on because they think it's just swell. And in some conservative parts of the country, there's a wink and a nod, and they think this is a great idea. If we find out that this is going on, then, of course, the situation can be addressed. And the way the situation is to be addressed is to call the attention of the administrators of the district, because the teaching of creationism in the United States is clearly illegal. And generally speaking, if you know, teacher Mr. Jones is teaching creationism, you call attention to the superintendent. You know, we understand Mr. Jones is teaching this material. Tell Mr. Jones to stop, or it's very likely that your school district is going to be sued. And if your district is sued, you are guaranteed to lose. Please consult your legal advisor for advice. And if the superintendent consults the legal advisor, the legal retainer would say, you know, run, don't walk, to Mr. Jones's office and tell him to cut it out now.
Really? So that is effective then?
Oh, the case law is so strong on this that there's just no way that this is going to go on. Oh yeah, I mean there's no question, because this is a no-brainer. On the other, it's step one, finding out whether Mr. Jones is, you know, who the Mr. Joneses are around the country, because who's going to turn these people in?
Right. So, audience, if you have questions about the history of evolution in the classroom, I noticed there have been a lot tonight. That's wonderful. Do give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 1. And we're also, as always, live at skepticallyspeaking.com and on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with the struggle to keep science in the classroom right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll talk to Dr. Rachie Dunlop, Australian scientist, podcaster, and skeptical investigator. We'll discuss her work as a scientist and researcher, as well as her efforts to promote reason and critical thinking to her fellow Australians. And Skeptic North editor Steve Toms joins us on Speaking Up with an update on Canada's first pan-provincial skeptical blog. Science and Skepticism with Dr. Rachie, next week on Skeptically Speaking. Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live on CJSR and at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education. We've been discussing teaching evolution in the school system, but now I'd like to turn to what we science-friendly types can do to help. So, Eugenie, what can people do besides report teachers that are teaching creationism?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that I prefer to be positive about this. A bigger problem than teachers teaching creationism, quite frankly, is the problem of teachers who skip evolution. And teachers who just don't really feel very confident about teaching evolution, so they tend to just maybe shortchange it a little bit. In the United States, we have science education standards in every state, and most districts have more or less adopted them, but that doesn't mean that the standards actually get taught. Generally speaking, evolution is in the standards for the state, and therefore the district should be teaching evolution, but there's often quite a slip twixt cup and lip, as the old saying goes, and by the time it gets all the way down to the classroom, whether evolution actually gets delivered to the kids, so to speak, is not necessarily always the case.
Right.
If you are a parent, be active in your child's education. When you go to the Back to Parents Night, be encouraging of your teacher in a very friendly and literally encouraging way. Let your child's science teacher know that you really are enthusiastic about science education. You'd love to help if you can. If the teacher needs to have somebody come just to help set up a lab, because, you know, inquiry learning, hands-on, minds-on type of learning, as opposed to just bubbling in sheets or the kinds of very boring checklist kind of science that tends to get done. Hands-on on laboratory and experiential learning takes setup, takes more time and effort. Offer to help. Offer to be that extra pair of hands to help set up and take down. Teachers are incredibly busy people. Offer to be that extra pair of hands, but also offer to do what you can to be that helpful person for that teacher, and let that teacher know that you really hope and expect that teacher, especially if it's at the middle school or high school level, to see that the curriculum is followed, and you really would like your child to learn evolution, to learn the full curriculum. And if there's anything you can do to help, if you happen to have a science background yourself, many of the people listening to this show do have a science background, you'd be happy to help if you have an area of expertise. Let the teacher know if you can come in and share your expertise with them. Now, you probably won't be called, but just the fact that you are willing to help is very useful.
Now we have Madden from Houston on the phone.
Hi, Dr. Eugenie Scott. It's a pleasure listening to you talk. I have a quick question. Why is evolution opposed strictly from a biological perspective? How about astrophysics or astronomy? Because even astrophysics or astronomy talks about a long time before everything came into existence. So why don't they oppose astronomy or astrophysics as well?
Oh, well, thank you so much for bringing that up, because you are completely correct. Cosmology also gets hammered by these folks. Not so much by the intelligent design people, but certainly the young Earth creationists also get after astronomers and physicists for age of the Earth and age of the solar system. And these folks have trouble too. Also, Earth science. Geologists and earth science educators also have problems when they try to talk about age of the Earth and geological processes. The young Earth creationists give them a very bad time. It's very difficult to teach modern geology if the students in your class have been taught that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. So thank you for allowing me to mention that as well. We tend to focus only on biological evolution, but by no means is that the only part of science that's being attacked. Unfortunately, creationism is an equal opportunity threat to science in general. It's not just man evolved from monkeys. It attacks every aspect of science you can think of.
Well, as with all education, this process is probably most effective while people are still children, before their minds have been all muddied up by the adults. So luckily there's a new book out that is trying to set that straight. Daniel Loxton, editor and illustrator of Junior Skeptic Magazine, has just published Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be. Now, Eugenie, you've had a chance to read the book?
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned that. That actually, you know, when you mention how can people help, in addition to supporting your local teacher, do what you can to try to get more resources to young people, to children. Now, a book like Daniel Loxton's book is a great book to donate to your local library, to your local school library, to your local public library. Make these resources available to kids. Buy it for your own kid. Give it to your grandkids.
Now, this book, now, evolution is kind of a big and potentially technical topic to explain to children or to any kind of younger audience. So would you say that the book manages to make that accessible?
Oh, I think this book is terrific. I really do. This is a book that I would say would be appropriate for, you know, like upper elementary, conceivably even for kind of maybe even middle school kids if they're not too advanced. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, some middle school kids would turn their nose up on this, but yeah, you know, some middle school kids are reading at this level, frankly. I mean, this is not too lower level for some middle school kids, believe it or not. But it's got beautiful drawings, and it really hits the basic concepts very nicely. It gets natural selection. It deals with topics that kids are really interested in. And including the questions of you know, some of the real puzzles. You know, what about the dinosaurs and human and footprints together? And what about the ideas of complexity? And you know, how did life get started in the first place? I mean, it's really neat. It's really a wonderful book. He's just done such a terrific job on it. I just am so delighted with this book.
And it also actually discusses the historical context, which I found interesting.
Yeah, but without being, you know, without being kind of stuffy about it.
That's exactly it.
Sort of just enough, you know. It doesn't get bogged down with Darwin and beetles and finches and stuff like that. Just a little bit of stuff, and the kid getting drowned in too many rabbits. You know, I mean, it's really cute.
Absolutely. So, do you think that this book is a good idea for a child who isn't interested in science at all? I think that's the distinction, because there's a lot of children who are interested in science. But would this be something that maybe kids who read comic books would be interested in, do you think?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's some comic booky things about it.
That's what I was thinking. I think it's really broad.
Yeah.
So actually, although your opinion
is... I think more for kids who already have a little bit of an interest in science.
You know, I would... I'm going to have to debate you on that, because okay. I have a segment with just a very short interview I did with a 9-year-old, Jaden, about this book. Uh-huh. Let's take a listen there. So if you could just tell us your name and a little bit about yourself.
I'm Jaden Buchanan. I like reading about cryptids, that creatures that haven't been scientifically proved, and I like playing video games.
So what did you think of the book?
I thought it was really good, but it had some basic things in it, and for some of the illustrations, they were really different. For the front cover, it was realistic, and then for most of the other things, it was very animated. but it had some interesting things about it, about evolution. I never knew who had come up with the thought of evolution, because I never knew about Darwin.
What did you know about evolution before you read the book?
I knew that anything that's passed on through generations, they'd usually get it from their parents. And some of the time, boys would get more traits from their fathers than their mothers, but it could end the other way around. But that might not always happen.
So you learned about Darwin in the book. What else did you find out that you didn't know?
I never knew how the eyes were formed and how they started as just pieces of skin, and then they formed a flat surface without a seal, and then it slowly started becoming indented, and then a layer started coming over it to protect it and to focus the eye.
So you usually read books about science?
No, not really.
So is this something that would encourage you to maybe read more books about science?
Yeah, maybe a little bit every now and then.
So if you had one thing to tell me about that you liked best about the book, what would it be?
I like the part about, I'm not sure how to pronounce it yet, I've known it for a little bit, but I just call it the Maliki Membe and the colocynth, because I've been interested about things like that were unknown.
So is this a book, do you think, that your friends would like reading, or would you encourage them to read it?
Yeah, I think some of them might like it.
Thank you so much. So that was a 9-year-old who doesn't consider himself really interested in science.
Excellent. Excellent. Wonderful.
I wonder what the science kids are like.
Oh, yeah. They'll love it. They'll love it. So there are more and more books now coming out for kids, but there aren't nearly enough. There aren't nearly enough. And this is a wonderful addition. This is a one. And there aren't a lot of... there aren't a lot of picture books, and you know, for this age group, and it's really great. I'm really delighted. This is truly brand new and hot off the press. So let's let people know about it as much.
Absolutely.
As we can.
Would you now? I'm just wondering, and maybe it's because I don't hang around a lot of kids, but would you consider him representative of his age group? Because suddenly, I have hope for the future.
I don't hang around with a lot of kids either. I mean, my kid is 26, so, you know, I'm kind of far away from that age group myself.
Well, if he's the next generation, I actually don't think we're doing too badly.
Yeah, I'll keep my fingers crossed. Let's hope he is.
So if you could give people sort of one last thought about what they can do to best help spread evolution, what would you say?
You know, it's going to sound funny, but... The best way that you can do something is talk to your neighbor. I'm starting to think that maybe the best way that we're going to make any changes in the world, just in general, is by talking to the people that we tend to not talk to. I mean, we tend to... there's too much stovepiping in the world. We tend to talk on our blogs to people who agree with us already. We tend to watch the TV shows or read the newspapers, the magazines that give us the point of view that we already agree with. But we don't really talk to the people that don't already agree with us, or, goodness knows, our neighbors and our relatives that we don't agree with. And maybe we have to figure out ways of persuading people who don't already agree with us that, you know, we need to start persuading people to come around to our point of view, and maybe we need to start practicing that.
Ooh, practice.
Rather than patting ourselves on the back for on our blogs of people who agree with one another.
Very well put, Eugenie.
So, you know, next time you're out in your yard or walking down the street and you run into your neighbor, tell them about a really interesting article that you read about, say, there was an article yesterday about now we know the colors of the feathers on the back of feathered dinosaurs. Wasn't that a neat article? You don't have to bash somebody over the head with how stupid the creationists are, but just get somebody thinking about what a neat thing science is.
I love that. And that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much, Dr. Eugenie Scott, for being on Skeptically Speaking.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you. And you can find Eugenie Scott and the National Center for Science Education at ncse.com. And you can order Daniel Loxton's Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be on skeptic.com or on Amazon. And you can find our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, which has links to all the ways to contact us, follow us, friend us, or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.